I think the practice of finding your places and your people, wherever they may be, creating your webs of connections, does need to begin earlier.
At Home with Growing Older is a nonprofit organization which believes in peer learning and creating discussions which bring the lens of aging to a variety of topics. At Home with Growing Older is proud to be your host of At Home on Air, a radio hour offering connection, community, and knowledge to our participants remotely. Now, we invite you to listen and learn from this live recorded episode of At Home on Air.
Welcome to At Home on Air. I'm Susie Stadler, the Executive Director of At Home with Growing Older and the producer of this podcast. At Home on Air is a forum to explore the work it takes to be at home with growing older, but also the delight which can come from doing this work. These explorations are made possible through the insights of inspiring guests from the arts, architecture, academic research, medicine, social services, and beyond, and through comments and questions from you, our listeners. So thank you for making time. In this season of At Home on Air, we are inviting community builders and placemakers to discuss their vital role in keeping us healthy and connected to our homes, our shared spaces, and the world around us. And in this episode, we are just thrilled to welcome someone who has spent years deeply studying the significance of these shared spaces, often called third spaces, the significance in the lives of older adults, and what they mean for all of us as a society. Stacy Torres is an assistant professor of social and behavioral sciences at the UCSF School of Nursing, and beyond her academic work, she's a gifted and prolific writer. Her newly published book, At Home in the City, Growing Old in Urban America, is the inspiration behind today's conversation. So welcome, Stacy.
Thank you so much.
Just briefly about the book. The book is an engaging and eye-opening account of her five-year ethnographic study following a group of old adults as they coped with the loss of a beloved neighborhood bakery. And many of us probably share a similar experience, a beloved neighborhood place, which is not there anymore. And this neighborhood bakery was their go-to hangout and gathering spot. The book is really a rich mix of voices, the members of the bakery club, as they called themselves after the closing, woven together with Stacy's own voice and research. And together they tell a deeply human story of growing old in urban America, set in the ultimate American city, New York. I'm reading this book and I'm just so mesmerized really by it. I can't stop reading it. And one of the things which really jumped at me was the acknowledgments in the beginning of the book. Stacy has, of course, a long list of people she acknowledges who contributed to writing this book and her research. But then there's also a list of places she acknowledges, which have been her home away from home, where she has worked, where she has studied, where she has researched. And I think we all have a list like this somewhere, if we're lucky. The places are in San Francisco, from the Royal Ground Coffee to the High Tide to Mario's Bohemian Cigar Store Cafe to the public library to Albany, New York, the Hudson River Cafe, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So all these places are really part of home, the network of home. When Stacy and I talked, one of the things she said, no matter how tired or low I feel some days, I always feel better after going outside, making a home in the city wherever I go. So Stacy, we would love to hear about your practice making a home in the city.
Well, thank you so much. Place, I think, is fundamental in shaping many of us. You know, I grew up in New York City. I talk about this a lot in the book, not just because the study is in New York City, but I feel like that place has shaped me for better or worse. I actually hated growing up in the city in New York City when I was growing up in the 80s and 90s. I longed for the suburbs. I longed to go to the mall. I longed, to ride a bicycle on quiet sidewalks. And it was only until years later I realized how much of my sensibility and the way that I interact with the world and access it was shaped by growing up in a very dense city. And so I think people and places really shape so much of who we are and what we are and how we relate. And I'm so pleased, Susie, that you have read my book with such a careful eye and noted the places that I acknowledge in the acknowledgments, because I felt like they were so fundamental to getting this book written. It was a long, long journey. It was much longer than I would have ever expected. I had optimistically promised my book editor a year after I graduated, I would turn in this manuscript. Well, it wasn't published till about 10 years later. And there were lots of things that happened. And anybody that has worked on a project, especially a book project for a long time, understands it's kind of like a renovation project, maybe, add a whole bunch more blood, sweat, tears, money, everything. But I was persistent and I just kept going. And not only the people in my life that I acknowledge, but those places kept me going. As Susie has rightly noted, we all probably have a sense of those places that we loved and maybe lost that provided us with some relationship, maybe just a daily hello that was so important. I really do not love the heat in the Bay Area when it spikes like this because there's no air conditioner, at least where I am. I'm out here in Oakland, kind of baking a little bit to escape. And I don't sleep well. I slept last night, but for two nights in a row, I didn't sleep well. And so even yesterday, I went to shout out to Sweet Bar Bakery in downtown, or I guess it's called Uptown Oakland, about 25th Street and Broadway. I said, look, I have a tight writing deadline. I know my spirit is going to sink. It's going to be hot alone in my house. So I said, well, you know what? I'd rather be hot outside with other people. And sure enough, I was a lot more productive and a lot more mentally happy than I would have been had I just kind of stayed home all day. One of the things that I really propose, maybe not so explicitly in the book, is just supporting small businesses. Most of the places that I mention are small businesses, and many of our small businesses are just struggling with the costs of everything going up. A lot of our immigrant-owned businesses are having different challenges. I could go on and on, but I'll pause there.
Yeah, one of the things I remember also from your book that you said the bakery was closed because sort of a more upscale New York bakery moved in and it really separated the people who actually could afford it from the people who could not afford it and suddenly created a divide. So this kind of occurrence is maybe a little strange to talk about businesses in terms of being inclusive, but really this is part of it, no?
Yeah, I mean, I think the challenge is, affordability is a huge concern across the country and gentrification and people feeling more and more excluded from not only home ownership, but their own neighborhoods at times as the character changes, real estate values increase. And so I've thought a lot about this, motivated by my own experiences growing up in one very different New York City. I was born a couple years after this famous headline in the New York Post when the city was bankrupt, Ford to City, drop dead. Now in the neighborhood where I grew up in Chelsea, you have something called the High Line. And a lot of benefits have come to people who have managed to stay in an area that's gentrifying in terms of safety increasing, different amenities that come up. I noticed that New York City, in particular, from my memory, is a lot greener than it used to be. I don't remember all those bushes and trees. And so that's a benefit. Even for people who maybe aren't displaced residentially, they manage to stay in the neighborhood. There can be a feeling of estrangement from your familiar environment, from places that make you feel welcome and included. It's even more subtle than just the price of a product is much more expensive at the new establishment that opens. But perhaps the whole feeling and sensibility of an establishment changes. The bakery where I spent so many years with these older people and it closed, and then this new place opened up. Not only was the price point more within the reach of people who were living on fixed incomes, who lived in public housing and lived in low and middle income housing, but also the feeling that they were included. It wasn't, so shiny and new. They would complain about the distressed furniture, but with affection too, like, oh, there's this plastic tablecloth that has a hole in it, but it wasn't so sleek. I remember in the new place, there was this very high pastry case, and people who were shorter stature could barely see over it. It was kind of a busier energy where people were not attended to by the counter person like they were in the old place. Even though it was sort of above her pay grade, she would bring people their coffee to their table if they couldn't walk easily with their walker and their coffee. She would pour the milk in for people who couldn't balance that task with also their cane. I'm a big fan of this concept, which I think, kind of goes part and parcel when we think about how neighborhood places changed. It's a Japanese concept called Ibasho. It sort of captures a sensibility of feeling belonging, accepted, that you feel comfortable in a place. Over the years, I have followed different developments. There was a business that opened up near Mission and 16th Street in San Francisco. It catered to a wealthier clientele, but they did make sure to keep at least one item that was more within the affordable range that people could purchase who lived in the neighborhood and, didn't have a fat wallet. And I thought at least that's a move in the right direction. I mean, one or two items is something that may allow you to come in to a place and maybe at least have a drip coffee, even if, the matcha latte with all sorts of exotic ingredients might be like $10 at this point. Businesses who know that they are kind of catering to maybe a wealthier, more well-heeled clientele, if they have some intention about the community and wanting to at least create a bridge, I think that that's very important. But often businesses are profit-minded and they also may do things subtly to exclude different customers that they may not want.
Exclude is sort of the jump-off point of my next question. So, aging in place or places really requires awareness of who has the right to feel safe and welcome in the space and who has the right to linger. You used the word loiter. What were the findings from your study?
I use the word loiter a little bit ironically and affectionately, and I count myself as a professional loiterer at this place, professional coffee shop goer as well. When I think about the concept of loitering, it brings to mind a situation that had erupted several years ago now in New York City, in a different neighborhood than where I conducted my research. There's a neighborhood in Flushing, Queens. Well, Flushing, Queens has a large Asian American population. And there was a situation with McDonald's there where some older Korean adults preferred to go to the McDonald's over the local senior center for many different reasons. And the management at this particular McDonald's called 911 on them for loitering because basically they said, look, these older adults are coming in here. They're buying maybe a cup of coffee or not and sitting there all day. And we have paying customers and we need them to vacate the spots. And so that got me thinking at that time. And I actually was able to publish an op-ed in the New York Times about McDonald's as a place where I spent a lot of years with older adults who loitered in a different neighborhood. It's challenging because these spaces often can be sort of open and public in some ways, but they're private businesses. And so it's not always straightforward, but at least in terms of the lessons that I learned where older adults were spending a long period of time in some of the spaces that were the most welcoming, the bar was rather low for entry. Like buy something, anything, and you could sit there for a really long time. Those were the kind of places and the conditions that encouraged loitering, but also encouraged community connection and a sense of belonging, which is really important for other outcomes that we care about, like blood pressure and warding off dementia and living a long, happy life. And this is not just something that's exclusive to older adults, but think about younger adults. There's been a rise in different establishments that has been restricting younger people from going there. And so a lot of times you have older people and younger people struggling to find places where they can access them, not just affordably, but where they feel safe, where they feel comfortable, where they can spend time, not just from a price standpoint, but, you know, can they get there? Can they stay there? Do they feel welcome there? Do they feel rushed there? Often we carry different social identities. Age is one. We have race. We have ethnicity. We have sexuality. We have immigrant status. I mean, this is becoming a huge heartache for people who do not feel comfortable going out even to bring their children to school now. And they feel unsafe going to the grocery store. And in different communities, volunteers are having to help them. So they're becoming more socially isolated. So I think it's really important to consider all of the different social identities. I think a lot about this, especially from the pandemic years, when attacks on older Asian adults were surging. Again, people not feeling safe to go out, already feeling maybe vulnerable due to age, and then vulnerable due to the way that they present in public, and feeling terrified of discrimination, yes, but also violence based on race and ethnicity. To the point where you had in different Chinatowns self-organized patrols to protect people. It's really complicated, but we should be cognizant of all of the different challenges that people face. And some people face many more, given a lot of different intersections of their identity. Some people maybe only face a few. And I just think there's so many different challenges that we face at many different ages that we have to think about this collectively together.
Stacey, since we're focusing especially on older adults, can you share some of the challenges your study group and your companions at the bakery faced to getting out and getting to these third spaces or shared spaces?
My study that I talk about in the book started at this little mom and pop bakery that was very centrally located for a lot of people. And actually, it was kind of interesting because over time, other establishments on that block had closed. And so people were kind of concentrated. It was like the last restaurant in a dying small town's main street. People were concentrated there. So it actually for a while brought people closer together until the store closed and the center kind of dropped out. But it's very centrally located. So you had three residential clusters around from which older customers lived and would go to this bakery. You had large public housing projects. And so you had, again, multiple buildings, which were quite tall, you know, for the Bay Area, like 11-story buildings up to 20-story buildings around the bakery, like within a block or a half block of this bakery. Then you had a large residential building that had a lot of rent controlled or rent stabilized tenants among market rate tenants. So you had some people who were holdovers and had lived there, you know, since the 70s, the 80s, and were able to remain in the neighborhood because they were able to maintain somewhat of an affordable rent.
I'm thinking about some passages in your book where you talk about the mobility challenges, the condition of the sidewalk or whatever, and how determined people, even who had mobility issues, were to get to this bakery. And I wonder if you can share some of the reasons why they were so determined.
People had a range of different physical problems. Some people didn't need any assisted device. You know, they were able to walk pretty comfortably, even miles and miles. But a fair number of people needed a cane or a walker or a wheelchair and were dealing with declines, you know, over the time of the study to the point where they could no longer walk. This was a real challenge to getting not just out of the house, but any distance away. And think, you know, if we compare with our area here where things are even more spread out, the distance of an extra block or two or three was insurmountable. For some people, they would try to take a taxi to this McDonald's after the bakery closed. There was one person I highlight in the book who I call Dottie, and she would go there every day to this bakery. It was basically under a block from her front door in the public housing projects. And the bakery closed, and she was having more and more knee pain, and she eventually had a heart attack. But before then, She would really struggle to go to the McDonald's to gather with people. She was a lifelong resident. She had lived all of her 80-something years in this neighborhood. She had never been on a plane. Her whole life was lived in a couple blocks in this neighborhood. And so it was a huge blow. People tried to help her to go to the other place, but then she felt like she was a burden. Even getting her in and out of a taxi was difficult. I spent one afternoon walking her home, and a walk that took me about 3 minutes, which was like basically the equivalent of two city blocks, took her 45 minutes with me. We had to pause. She was sweating profusely, and it wasn't 80 degrees that day. It was really, really difficult. But I was very fortunate to be able to spend that time with her and to understand, what her lived experience was and her walking routes and why this place was so important. It was her social world. With many of the people I spent time with, going out is essential to their functioning, to their mental health, to their physical functioning. That's the thing. If you have an injury or some kind of decline, you don't want to run a marathon necessarily, but if you are not able to continue to push yourself to go out, social skills atrophy, muscles atrophy. My father was an immigrant from Chile, and he was very, very worried about his health his whole life. And his kind of mindset was, oh, if something hurts, I better not touch it. I better not move. And I told him, Dad, that's exactly the wrong thing. If you have some kind of injury or issue that comes up, you need to stretch. You need to push yourself a little bit, within reason. I mean, I'm not a physical therapist, but there is this concept of wanting to make sure you're not learning helplessness and like this person fit environment, on and on. This group, they were not the shut-ins. They were not the isolated people. They really had a sense that they needed to go out and go out pretty much every day and connect with people. And even people who were a little bit less socially involved wanted to be around people, if not necessarily forced to interact with them when they went out.
You said social skills atrophied, and that's just so true. And so, you have to keep practicing your social skills because it's really a contributor to your health. It leads me also to this main statement in the book. We always think about aging in place as something which is a late life thing, aging in place, the word says it, but you talk about it as a lifelong practice. Can you say a little bit more what the difference is between considering this as a late life event versus thinking about it as a lifelong practice? And what is this practice?
I think the practice of finding your places and your people, wherever they may be, creating your webs of connections, I mean, it really does need to kind of begin earlier. Spending so much time with older people and really many older women has made me consider my own aging in place as I'm doing it. I remember when I wrote that New York Times op-ed, the editor really disliked this phrase, aging in place, which you see a lot in gerontology. She said, well, we're all aging in place, and we are. I just turned 46 last week. I'm aging in place, and knock on wood, if I continue to live and we all continue to live, we will all continue to age in place. Spending time with people who are decades and decades older than me really had me thinking about where are the places that I go? How can I continue to go out if I have an injury or if I have like a psychic injury? And I did have a lot of upheaval in my life as I was doing the study and making the book. I left a long relationship. I was out in San Francisco. I didn't know anybody. It was harrowing. Then I found somebody. We moved to upstate New York. Then we moved back here. I had to sort of think about, okay, how did the older people handle like a lot of unstructured time on a weekend? How did they become a regular at a place? And so I think that this is something that we all have to think about early on and also at different transition points. Like maybe we move somewhere else, or we get a new job, or we retire, or we lose somebody in our lives. We lose a partner, or we gain somebody. Maybe we need to flee. Maybe it's too much together time and we need to find a secret place for ourselves once in a while. It's just really important to think about this at all different ages. And that's the challenge sometimes for people, especially when they do have a big transition, like they retire. And I would retire today if I could. I would do the things that I like. But for some people, it's really difficult to figure out, okay, what do I do with myself now that I don't have that structure in place? And so I think laying the groundwork, whether it's you go to the YMCA, you find your favorite coffee shop, maybe you pick up a hobby. a lot of young people who have had to kind of come of age in the pandemic are struggling with this. I just read some casual article the other day about younger people picking up quote unquote grandma hobbies like crocheting and needlepoint and wanting some kind of escape from screens in that time. I remember a couple months ago, I had to use the restroom and I was in New York City and I went to the library where I had got my first library card, my childhood library in the West Village near the school where I had attended. And I went down to the basement and there was this room and it was filled with young people, mostly young women, knitting. And I used to knit a long, long time ago. And I asked what was going on. And it's a part of a meetup that they have in the library and they knit. They're making Afghans to like donate Afghan blankets. That was really cool. And so maybe between having to kind of still deal with the fallout of the pandemic and having to deal with figuring out how to navigate our digital lives and our in-person lives, maybe in a way, it's a blessing in disguise to try to intentionally create some of these networks earlier on.
Yeah, and I feel like it's also about having a shared purpose, doing something together. That's one of the most successful things to connect. Before we go to some questions and comments as a summary and as a call to action, can you read a passage from your book?
Yes, absolutely. Thank you. So this is from page 206 in At Home in the City. As growing numbers of older adults live longer, they will need to seek a range of support for health-related challenges. My findings suggest more will rely on company in informal spaces as a supplemental and in some cases primary form of support as they age in their communities. In line with prior scholarship that has found ageism in healthcare settings, greater mistrust of the medical system among racial and ethnic minority elders, and dislike of age-separated institutions like senior centers, these findings suggest a greater need for understanding elders' options for alternative spaces and for further research on how elders reach beyond formal settings to remain healthy and independent.
Thank you. Yeah, call to action for more alternative spaces, which are our home away from home, and how to really create them.
You are listening to At Home On Air. We are now switching to questions by participating audience members in this recorded live episode. If you want a chance to ask your question, visit us at athomewithgrowingolder.org and register for the next live episode.
Allegra asks, how much is elders' angst about losing a sense of home just a fear of change and just not being adaptable?
Well, that's a good question, because a lot of times I struggle with change too, and fear of it. It's difficult. But I do think I would try to move away a little bit from maybe a potential stereotype of older adults being inflexible, set in their ways. Like you hear that in that old phrase, old dog can't learn new tricks or something to that extent. And I guess my book and my findings, I would really highlight actually the incredible adaptability and flexibility of the older people I spent time with. They had to refashion their lives and routines a lot. You know, I can't speak for everyone, and I'm sure that there is some just kind of stubbornness and resistance to change. I'm in that camp a lot of times. I'm like, oh, this is just, I don't like this. And then I open my mind to something like, oh, actually, I kind of do like this new coffee shop. But I would say that holding on to a place, a beloved place, for good reasons, the conditions that made it so special and so accessible and so welcoming in terms of its inclusivity, its proximity, the idea that there was sort of a creative impulse, you could make the place what you wanted. I think those are the reasons why that fear was so pronounced. You know, it was so beloved because people were really able to make it their own. And even in the places that they found afterwards, they did kind of identify those conditions and reproduce at least some of those elements in the new places. So the group I spent time with, and probably many people, I don't think it was just irrational terror of change.
as an older adult, you have to be super nimble. You have to be so nimble to adjust to change and physical change, which really can change how you inhabit the world. And I think there is a legitimate sort of fear of these changes and the fear that you actually won't be able to continue to do what you love to do. So nimbleness is a really big lesson to learn.
The fear of falling or the fear of doing something can be a hindrance. I have a chronic illness myself, and so a lot of times I'm like, oh, I think I might have a pain now in my leg for a long time or maybe forever. I'm going to have to just deal with it. But I do. I think a lot of people are able to be like, okay, I'm going to kind of figure this out in some way. So I remain hopeful.
That's the big learning, I think. So Judy says, I truly enjoyed your book, but what are you working on now? Are you focusing on third spaces in the Bay Area? You suggested that it could be helpful for healthcare professionals to hang out at these third spaces and be available to give better advice. Are you pursuing that?
It's a great question. Actually, I've been in the field launching my next project. And so I've been spending the last couple years shadowing a friend who is dealing with a lot of serious challenges around mental health and substance use and formerly homeless, formerly incarcerated, but now housed in an SRO. And so I've been branching out through him and getting to know people in his networks and trying to understand his challenges with social isolation and people in his networks, their challenges too. And so, yeah, that research has brought me to trying to find places. There's a lovely park across from the building where he lives. I've been spending time in that park and getting to know people who live in his building to see how they use that space. There's a coffee shop like a half block away where people go, and then some people don't go, but also really understanding the challenges too. Even the price, like there's a gas station with really cheap coffee near his house, and we go for this coffee at the gas station, but it's not really a place to sit. But he has this park. So people are, again, are able to adapt with like, okay, I can't afford maybe the $6 blue bottle coffee where the tech workers are hanging out, but like we can go to the gas station and like bring the $2.59 gas station coffee to the park and kind of enjoy being out together. So thank you for that question. And thank you, Judy, for your read of my book. I really appreciate that.
I think it would be a cool idea for healthcare professionals to hang out at cafes.
Absolutely. Meet people where they are. I'm not as familiar with how casework happens here in San Francisco, but I have a sister who was diagnosed many years ago with schizophrenia. She was hospitalized inpatient for 3 months. I'm her primary caregiver. And I remember when she had her caseworker, they would meet at like McDonald's in the park. And so I think that that would be great. And they probably are. They are probably doing it, but I think many more would be great. Meeting people where they're at out in the world.
Yeah, I think it would be great for both parties. Joan asks a big question. I think many are thinking about the same. Have you or anyone you know been looking into options for people who don't want to live alone, but also don't want to move to an elder community with all the levels of care? And if you don't want to live alone in an apartment for social reasons, not simply financial reasons, that's sort of a big question. Maybe Stacy, you have some thought about different forms of communal livings, and I have some ideas too.
Thank you, Joan, for that question and observation. Susie, actually, you're probably much more capable, given your organization's focus around this, to answer. But I don't really like living alone either, you know, but it doesn't mean that I want to live in a prescribed environment either. So I would say a couple of things. With the cost of living, there are different programs rising up. I actually met a student at NYU in New York City who's renting a room from an older person who could use some additional income, but also doesn't want to live alone. And so I think kind of roommate situations in some ways, or communal houses, like people talk about, you know, the Golden Girls is that kind of golden model of, oh, you know, let's come together. It wasn't about older adults necessarily, but I thought this was always like such a cool idea. There was a show set in New York City in the 1980s that I loved called Kate and Ally. And it was about two divorcees with their children, raising them together, and they were all living together. And I was so sad at the end of the series when like one of the women gets married and then they move in with him. I was like, it was so great before. But informal arrangements springing up more like that, home sharing programs, some cities are actually cultivating those. Of course, you have different village movements, which may be involved in like matchmaking services in terms of people's share opportunities. The place that I had mentioned, the SRO where my friend Greg lives, that I'm working on a book about his experiences and his networks, is kind of a really nice setup in terms of it's a beautifully renovated SRO. There's shared bathrooms, so he doesn't have to clean the bathroom. There's a shared kitchen. They have like some other shared spaces, and actually they have different art groups that meet there and residential meetings that happen. Like if I didn't live with my partner, I would love a situation like that if I could. So I'm very glad that he has that and those supports. A lot of people would love to have that. I think the financing is challenging for lots of different reasons. So those are offhand a couple of the ideas, but I think that that's a growing desire. How to implement it exactly, it seems to be a patchwork with lots of different challenges, but I remain hopeful about some opportunities. Susie, did you want to chime in?
Well, I think there are lots of different ways to do it, and it depends on somebody's living situation. Like, I have a housemaid, a young woman, and we're not buddies, but we sometimes cross paths in the yard, and it's a great thing. She sometimes takes care of my dog, and I live in a neighborhood where people know each other. I think that's also a big deal, that your neighbors sort of become part of the elastic ties, which Stacy also talks about. But it's very individual. Talking to friends, also how they do it, is one way to structure it or explore it. There's a whole program called Home Match from a company called Front Porch to actually match you with people. So there is a formal program about this. I feel like there are always young people who need an inexpensive place to live. That's sort of a good resource for housemates, just food for thought. And then Judy said, Joan, are you aware of Niklas Dewar, Dewar? He's facilitating a group who is trying to build co-housing in San Francisco. There are a number of co-housing projects, and I think co-housing is a pretty cool way to live together.
I think also cool people will like want to live there. There's probably a lot of artists that would also take up in co-housing. When I lived in one of my only roommate situations, because I had mostly lived with my family in an overcrowded apartment or with my ex-husband or with my partner now. But I remember I lived, and I write about this in the book, in the Richmond. There was a person who rented rooms to students. I was a student at the time. And I lived with a retired taxi driver from Dublin, Ireland, originally. He was retired from DeSoto Cab Company, and he played the piano. And we had these kind of passing exchanges. It wasn't like we were best buddies, although I did kind of get brought into the fold of his friendship group. We did go to like Golden Gate Fields and bet on the ponies. He shared his milk with me if I ran out, and vice versa. It was nice for me to have that kind of light interaction, somebody there, but like without the pressure.
Yeah. And Lisa says a comment. I go to a neighborhood cafe almost daily. It opened during COVID. It's a dog cafe. And so many people who have dogs gather in the morning when they're walking their dogs. I don't have a dog, but go and sit outside with the dog owners, many of whom have become friends. So a neighborhood cafe like this is a perfect place. Also, if it has outdoor seating, that sort of counter trend really formed during COVID.
There's a cat cafe in Oakland. They're offering the cats for adoption. But I think it also brings together, again, like coffee and dogs, coffee and outdoor spaces, the elements that people like. I like getting older. I mean, you get to know yourself and your sensibilities. There was a writer for the New York Times. She was an American living in Paris. Her name is Pamela Druckerman. And she had a book about getting into your 40s. And I think at the time I was in my 30s. She had a chapter about finding your tribe, finding your people. And so, again, somebody who detests dogs probably doesn't want to go to this cafe. That's fine. Maybe there's some other place that they will go where they enjoy their surroundings. I just really appreciate when there are options. And we're really spoiled for choice, here and in other cities. There are, of course, challenges. I mean, we have rural areas where if the only main store closes down and that was the hub for people to gather, I mean, that's a huge loss. Thank you for sharing that information.
Judy says also, I'm a lousy pickleball player, but there is a diverse group who hangs out at the indoor courts at Noe Valley. I'm very aware that I go to socialize as much as to play. So that's also a good thing. There can be different ways you participate. It can be very active or it can be more passive, but you're still part of an activity. I think that's a really nice example.
I was just going to add a couple of months ago, I was just in the Ferry Building and I hadn't been there for a long time. This is the Ferry Building in San Francisco. And there's a huge now interest and resurgence in Mahjong. And it was on a day where they had all of these tables set up for Mahjong. It was all different people, all different ethnicities, races, ages, young people, older people. So I thought that was great. And I've never played Mahjong. In my book, one of the older people did not want to go to the senior center and play Mahjong. But I enjoyed just kind of watching the people play. I just enjoyed being a spectator for that afternoon.
Yes. Crystal says, would cultivating friendships with younger people, a generation or two younger than oneself, help with finding community as well as interesting conversations and feeling more inclusive? I have lost friends who have moved away or passed away, and I look towards cultivating conversations with my younger friends over lunch. Is this happening more in society?
You know, it's interesting. I listened to a segment this afternoon. I think it was the program Here and Now on NPR. And it was about like a telephone program where a younger person, an older person were talking and having kind of an interesting conversation. I don't know if it's happening more. I have to say, I don't know what the statistics are. I do feel like I see programs springing up to try to help foster these connections. I kind of joke. In my own line of work as a professor, like, yeah, I'm making friends with my students because I'm gonna need them when they're like 10, 20, 30 years younger than me. I really try to stay away from prescribing any course of action for people like, do this, don't do that. I hate those articles in the newspaper, like, you're washing your clothes wrong. Here's how to do this the right way. And, maybe some people are just like, look, I don't want anything to do with younger people. I don't know their celebrities or lingo. That's fine. Again, you've got to find your tribe. The opportunities where I have had intergenerational relationships with different people, both younger and older than me, I really like them. One of the ways to kind of test the waters at these coffee shops that I go to, they'll have a barista who's like several decades younger than me. We'll chat. The other day, I saw one wearing some t-shirt with Tower Records and the name of a Japanese city. And I grew up going to Tower Records in New York City. We would hang there. We would listen to CDs because you couldn't just go on YouTube and listen to everything. We would spend all night there and they closed all of them down. But apparently they are still open in Japan. I've read about them. And she's like, yeah, she went there and she actually has CDs and she loves them because they are tangible. She's definitely Gen Z. I'm guessing she's not more than 25 years old. And so that's really cool. I just love to have these exchanges. And so that might be a way to kind of test, like, do I feel comfortable interacting with somebody a couple decades younger? And if not, that's okay. Free to be you and me, whatever you like.
What you shared before, this knitting group in the library, everybody could join the knitting group. This sort of shared activities, I think, are pretty ageless. And what's the risk? I mean, to join a group like this.
Yeah, exactly. I have library cards all over the place. Like the Berkeley Public Library, they have a great list of events. You can even learn how to be a barista, learn about gardening, learn about all of this stuff. And I don't know how to do any of that stuff. So I love the ones that are kind of easy entree. Like, let's just go and learn a little bit. Maybe there's a regular group. I grew up being a very painfully shy person and scared to interact with people. And I'm still very introverted, but I guess I've become a little bit extroverted as well. What's the worst you can do? You walk in the room, you don't like it, you walk out. It's like nothing lost.
Yeah, I agree. And I also have to say, dogs are fantastic connectors.
There's actually a paper I cite, a sociology paper, and there's a sociologist that studied a lot of the dynamics in dog parks and how different groups of people interacted. Well, there's this classic sociologist named Irving Goffman who wrote a lot of books. One of them was called Behavior in Public Places. His theory was, and I think it bears out, that when you're talking to the dog, a lot of times you're really talking to the owner.
Yes, that's totally true. Andrea says, check out local economy gathering space in Rockridge, a new attempt to be a place where folks can intersect. That sounds really interesting. We're not the only ones who feel this need to connect in person, not just in older age and intergenerationally. So there seems to be a real response to this and different experiments, how this can be brought about. I also have to say, as an Austrian, lingering and loitering is also a cultural practice, which you do a lot in Austria, so it comes fairly easy to me. So I would encourage lingering in places and starting a conversation. Howard also says, I have found volunteering is a good way to find people I want to hang out with and gain entry into third spaces that I might not have been able to be in before. That's really, really true. Also, what has come up, going back to school. I have a friend who is in her early 70s who decided to get a law degree. So many ways to take a risk out there and be together. And the third spaces are really an important part of this. Any last comments from you, Stacy, to send us on our way into our homes away from home?
Just in line with the comments, I just wanted to thank the audience for sharing all these resources and experiences and questions. The sum is greater than the parts, you know, that we all contribute to creating really our social infrastructure. It's more than just one cafe or one dog park or one library or one volunteering operation or one spiritual space. These are all building blocks to create our social infrastructure, which is just as important as our medical systems and our other institutions and our public transit systems. All of these work in concert together to support our mental and physical and emotional and social health. And investing in that, you know, where do we put our money? Where do we put our time? Where do we invest our resources? Who do we vote for? Who are the elected public officials that are creating the spaces that we need to live a long and healthy life? So I would just encourage us all to, as we can, take an inventory and continue to kind of take inventory of our neighborhoods and our spaces and really hold those who have some power to influence them accountable as well. So thank you, everyone. Thank you so much, Susie, for a wonderful conversation. And again, it doesn't end here. We'll all go out and continue our conversations and our efforts.
That's right. Thank you so much, Stacy. And thank you, everybody. Go out and talk to each other. Bye, everybody. Thank you.
Bye-bye. Thank you.
This episode of At Home On Air was produced by the At Home with Growing Older team. We could not host these conversations without the generosity of our marvelous and passionate guests and hosts. Thank you for sharing your personal and professional insights. Thank you to our live audience for your thoughtful contributions. To subscribe to this podcast and for more information, visit us at homewithgrowingolder.org. At Home with Growing Older strives to educate, inspire, and connect people across generations and disciplines to re-envision and improve the experiences of later life. Don't forget to subscribe and tune in for the next episode.